This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Our offices in Edmond, Oklahoma are home to Herbert W. Armstrong College, and each summer we invite teenagers from all over the world to join us for 3 weeks at Philadelphia Youth Camp. Last week, the campers came to the KPCG studio for a tour, and we asked them some questions about their dorms, their camp experiences, and our station manager, Dwight Falk, assembled a montage of their answers. We'll play that for you later in the program in order to give you a taste of what the campers are up to. I'm sure you'll enjoy that. And also at the end of the program, our last word today is an important personal lesson from the recent congressional testimony of FBI agent Peter Strzok regarding what to do when you're caught doing something you shouldn't be doing. Before that, though, we have a couple of news stories. In our second segment, we're going to talk about Cuba. The National Assembly in this country just passed a new draft constitution that seems to be moving the nation away from its Marxist, Leninist, communist roots. What might this mean for this strategically important nation just off of America's coast? We're going to hear about the potential economic, geopolitical, and prophetic ramifications in a report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller. We're going to start the program, though, in China. The Trumpet has been watching China's aggressive activities in the South China Sea for some years now with quite a lot of alarm, but it seems there's a growing sentiment both among China's neighbors in Asia and even among some people in the West that maybe the best thing to do is just let China have this strategic sea gate. This is very dangerous thinking, as we will now hear in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
We cannot stop China from doing his thing. Declare war against China? I can. But we'll all lose our military and policemen tomorrow. And we are a destroyed nation.
That was Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte speaking on March 19th of 2017 about the Scarborough Shoal. Scarborough is a large coral atoll covering about 56 square miles of territory with a reef-rimmed lagoon. It's a very rich fishing grounds, and it lies about 120 nautical miles from the Philippines coast, which means it is well within the Philippines' internationally recognized territory. But in 2012, China illegally seized it from the Philippines. China didn't take it for the fishing, though. The reason the Chinese wanted Scarborough was to make it part of China's strategic triangle plan to assert control over the South China Sea. The other two points of the triangle are the Spratly Archipelago and the Paracel Islands. In 2013, the year after China had occupied Scarborough, it started building artificial islands in the Spratly chain. And then in 2016, China deployed missile batteries to one of the Paracel Islands. The eyes of Asia throughout all of this were locked on the United States. Since the end of World War II, the U.S. military has kept the vital trade routes through the South China Sea open. And China's aggressive takeovers here were in areas claimed by U.S. partners, such as the Philippines and Vietnam. So it was plain for everyone to see that China's goal was to control these vital shipping lanes. So the nations of this region were sure that America would take some kind of action. But the Obama administration did little more than wag its finger. The idea of conflict with China was unthinkable. So the U.S. let it continue taking over the South China Sea. America's partners and allies took note of U.S. inaction, and they grew fearful. That's why Duterte said the Philippines should basically stand down and let China have its way. China also took note of U.S. inaction, and it grew emboldened. The Chinese accelerated their illegal island building and quietly continued to militarize more and more territory. The South China Sea contains immense natural resources, and trillions of dollars in trade pass through it every year. Because of this, it's been called the world's most valuable commercial artery. If China closed its grip on this important region and asserted firm control over it, that would represent a major loss to global security and stability. But Duterte is not the only person saying that at this point, the best course of action is to basically just let China have it. Ellie Ratner of the Center for a New American Security said that many in the West feel that we should just hand it over to China. He described the view of these individuals saying, quote, "From their vantage point, accommodation is preferable to risking war over a bunch of rocks," end quote. Some who believe that China should be allowed to assert control over the South China Sea have even published reports and analyses showing that trade could be rerouted through other waterways, and that it would not be too terribly expensive to do this. So they basically say, what's the harm? Let's just let China have it and reroute those ships. This kind of reasoning may sound extreme, but it probably isn't far removed from the kind of thinking that made the Obama administration decide not to take action against China's grab of Scarborough or its militarization of the Spratlys and Paracels. America chose not to confront those illegal behaviors, and in so doing, the U.S. showed that the South China Sea was a price it was willing to pay to keep the peace. And of course, peace is invaluable, but the problem with appeasement and giving in to expansionist powers is that it generally only emboldens those powers and makes war more certain. The late Winston Churchill understood this truth very well. He once said, quote, "An appeaser is one who feeds a crocodile, hoping it will eat him last." The reason Churchill knew this truth, besides from his careful study of history, was that before he became Prime Minister of Great Britain, Churchill had personally seen political leaders try to secure peace by appeasing an expansionist nation. Here's a clip from September 30th of 1938, and the voice here is Churchill's predecessor, Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain.
"This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again."
Earlier that morning, Chamberlain, along with the President of France, had signed a deal allowing Hitler and Nazi Germany to have control over a part of Czechoslovakia called the Sudetenland. This part of Czechoslovakia was of great strategic importance to the nation, and Czechoslovakia was an ally to France and Britain. But Hitler had threatened to take the Sudetenland by force, and Chamberlain and the other British and French leaders wanted to avoid war at all costs. They thought that by giving the Sudetenland to Germany willingly, Hitler's regime would be placated and conflict could be avoided. And you can hear in Chamberlain's speech there that he genuinely thought it would secure peace. He said, "I believe it is peace for our time." And you can hear that the people there in London were overjoyed. They all thought that by handing the Sudetenland over to Hitler, war had been avoided and peace had been secured. And Britain was not alone in this optimism. The United States administration of Franklin D. Roosevelt also supported the agreement to give part of Czechoslovakia to Hitler. Gallup polls in the U.S., Britain, and France found that the majority of people in all three nations supported it too. But the deal, of course, did not bring peace. Within a few months, the Nazis had taken control of the rest of Czechoslovakia. A short time after that, they invaded Poland. And then Britain and France had no choice but to declare war on Nazi Germany. World War II had begun. By the time it was over, more than 50 million lives had been lost, the deadliest conflict in human history. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote about this historic appeasement in his booklet, Winston S. Churchill, The Watchman. He wrote, quote, "The U.S. was even more pacifist than Britain. How could so many of our leaders in the U.S. and Britain, almost all of them, have been so weak in dealing with Hitler?" Mr. Fleury provides the answer, saying that Chamberlain and those other leaders, quote, "lacked the courage to face the brutal truth about Hitler." In his booklet, Mr. Fleury explains that younger generations of Americans and Britons have not learned from this history. He wrote, quote, "We simply lack the will to deal with tyrants and finish the job. We have a pathetic lack of will in a very dangerous world. We can't afford the pacifist attitude we had before World War II and survive nationally. Yet our pacifist attitude today is far worse than it was then." End quote. The South China Sea is one area where we can really see the U.S. and U.K.'s lack of will on display. And some individuals have said that the sea is basically the Sudetenland of World War III. Duterte's predecessor, Benigno Aquino III, compared the two in 2014, saying, quote, "At what point do you say enough is enough to China? The world has to say it. Remember that the Sudetenland was given in an attempt to appease Hitler to prevent World War II. And then Dan Eberhardt of the Los Angeles World Affairs Council has also said the South China Sea is a modern Sudetenland. He said, quote, "The Obama administration failed to forcefully confront China as it expanded its territorial claims in the South China Sea, dutifully playing the role of Neville Chamberlain as China intimidated our allies. In the absence of American power, China's appetite for expanding its influence and territorial claims in the South China Sea went largely unchecked." And then Eberhardt said the result has been, quote, "an emboldened China that has militarized its position in the region and has been openly aggressive." And then Eberhardt added that if China's territorial expansion continues to be left unchecked, it will expose the whole of Southeast Asia to China's nationalist goals. Now, it is true that U.S. President Donald Trump has begun to take a somewhat firmer stance against China's expansionism in the South China Sea. President Trump has increased the tempo of U.S. military patrols in the region, including a recent operation that sailed a guided missile cruiser and a destroyer past the Paracels. That looks like a step in the right direction, but Bible prophecy shows that America's measures to stand up to China at this point are too little too late. Scripture shows that American resolve will not last, and that China will keep on tightening its grip on this vital sea to the detriment of global peace. In the Trumpet's July 2016 issue, Mr. Fleury said Beijing's tightening grip on this area is, quote, "steering the world toward war." He said China is challenging 7 decades of American naval dominance in the Pacific Rim, and that this belligerent behavior should alarm the world. Mr. Fleury explained that since the U.S. is now retreating from the region, quote, "other great powers are coming in to fill the vacuum. China is intimidating the nations of Southeast Asia into submission to its will. It is forcing these countries to do it at once. Everything is headed in the direction of war." Mr. Fleury's analysis of the South China Sea situation is founded on the sure word of Bible prophecy. A little later in that powerful article, he quotes a part of the book of Deuteronomy in which God issues a warning to the people of Israel, saying that if they reject him, then God will hand control over the world's strategic sea gates to their enemies. The warning says that these enemy nations would then use that control to besiege the nations of Israel. Mr. Fleury made clear that this warning is not intended only for ancient people. He writes, quote, "It is a prophecy for the modern-day descendants of Israel. Two nations in particular represent Israel in this end time, America and Britain. These two countries are full of terrible sins today, and God is going to correct them for that. This prophecy and several others show that he will send foreign enemies to punish America and Britain." End quote. So America's failure to confront China as it tightens its grip on the South China Sea, is leading to the fulfillment of this prophecy. It will not prevent war, just like America and Britain's efforts to appease Nazi Germany did not prevent war. This points to some very dark days in the near term, but Mr. Fleury explained that there is also great cause for hope in these trends, because this approaching war is tied to good news. His article concludes with these words: "All this prophesied destruction is what it will take for God to reach this world. After this, people will be ashamed, and they will get to know God." Ezekiel talked repeatedly about that inspiring conclusion. Yes, there is a lot of bad news when you consider what it takes to get people to the point of knowing God, but ultimately, the outcome is spectacularly good news.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. So watching China undertake the militarization of this area, you were talking at the beginning of the report about this strategic triangle and these other two points on that triangle, the Scarborough Shoal being the final piece of that triangle. So I'm assuming, since this is something that they just took over, that they haven't militarized this area the way that they have those other two. Maybe you could just give us an update on where they are in this plan for securing that triangle.
Sure, yes. I think the other two points are basically secure. In the Paracels and in the Spratlys, they have significant military installations. In the Spratlys, they haven't yet moved bombers and fighter jets, but they have everything ready for them to be there. And once jets are in both of those locations, then those two areas would be essentially secured. Now, with Scarborough, they did seize it in 2012, and they won't let Philippine fishermen or anyone else in there without China's permission. So they have control, but they've not yet militarized it. In fact, they haven't even turned the shoal into an island, and they promise that they won't. But those promises mean little. You know, we've seen them promise that with parts of the Spratlys very recently. So once China made the if they make the decision, which I believe is very likely, to island build in that area and then to militarize it, it wouldn't take long at all. And with those three points, if they had their bombers on all three of those locations, then they'd be able to quickly assert an air defense identification zone, which would mean even aircraft flying over that area would have to get China's control.
Yeah, they definitely move fast when they want to, and we've seen that in those other two locations, and you can see the satellite imagery showing just how rapid the buildup can be once they decide to make a move. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. He's working on an article on this subject for the September 2018 print edition of the Trumpet magazine. At this point, the working title is This the Peace in Our Time of World War III? You can watch for that on the website in the next couple of weeks. And also, if you're interested in more information about that history of Churchill and World War II, we do have Gerald Fleury's booklet, Winston S. Churchill, The Watchman. And there's also Gerald Fleury's booklet on Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet. You can check those out on thetrumpet.com. Jeremiah, we appreciate you bringing us up to speed on that.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Cuba has just passed a new draft constitution that seems to be moving the nation away from its communist roots. What might this mean for this strategically important nation just off America's coast? We'll learn about the potential economic, geopolitical, and prophetic ramifications in this report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller.
After 60 years of communist rule, Cuba may be experiencing a perestroika moment. Revolutionary leader Fidel Castro died 2 years ago, and his brother, Raúl Castro, turned over Cuba's presidency to Miguel Díaz-Canel last April. Now Cuba's National Assembly has adopted a draft constitution that would limit the president to serving 2 5-year terms. This new constitution would also divide the powers of Cuba's current presidency between a president and a prime minister and officially recognize private property. The constitution, which allegedly must be approved by a nationwide referendum, keeps the Communist Party as the guiding force of a one-party system and enacts many of the same economic and political forms that Communist China implemented in the 1980s. This means that Cuba may soon abandon its traditional Marxist-Leninist approach to government in favor of a mixed socialist market economy run by a Chinese-style bureaucracy. These changes to Cuba's Soviet-era constitution are designed to make the nation's brand of socialism more sustainable. They will also make it easier for Cuba to establish strong economic connections with Europe. Due to Cuba's role in arming rebels and American-allied countries around the world and providing a safe haven for refugees wanted in the United States, the U.S. State Department named the communist regime as a state sponsor of terror in 1982. Former U.S. President Barack Obama removed Cuba from the list of state sponsors of terrorism in 2015 and called on Congress to lift the U.S. economic embargo against the island. Yet President Donald Trump has rolled back this policy of rapprochement due to Cuba's continuing support for human traffickers and terrorists. With tensions between Cuba and America remaining high, the communist regime is doubling down on its outreach to Europe. Last week, Cuba's Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs attended a ministerial meeting between the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States and the European Union. At this meeting, the head of European diplomacy reiterated the European Union's commitment to establishing strong bilateral relations with Cuba and condemned the U.S. blockade against the island. In an interview with Prensa Latina, the Cuban minister stressed that, to the extent that the anti-Cuban measures of Donald Trump's administration are intensifying, the fact that relationships with Europe are increasing is an extremely positive element and establishes an important contrast in political terms. The fact that Cuba's communist government is starting to act more like China than North Korea will only make it easier for the European Union to reach out to Cuba and establish a foothold on America's southern border. Roughly 57% of U.S. seaborne exports and 44% of U.S. seaborne imports pass through the Gulf of Mexico. This makes Cuba's location at the mouth of this gulf extremely significant. As Peter Zeehan wrote for Stratford back in 2008, a hostile power in Cuba could fairly easily seal both the Straits of Florida and the Yucatan Channel, reducing the Gulf of Mexico to little more than a lake. The threat of naval blockade is why the U.S. took Cuba from Spain in 1898 and why it unsuccessfully tried to oust the Soviet Union from Cuba in 1962. In his article, The Deadly Dangerous U.S.-Cuba Deal, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flory explained that President Barack Obama's push to normalize relations with Cuba was largely the handiwork of the Vatican. Both Pope Francis and his predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI, worked to open Cuba to U.S. markets. Now President Trump is trying to reverse the policy, but Germany and the Vatican still desire a strong presence on the communist island. The Bible prophesies of a deadly economic siege that's going to strike America in the near future. In one particular prophecy in Isaiah 5 and verse 5, God likens the United States to a hedged vineyard protected on all sides. It has been hedged north, south, east, and west by non-threatening nations and the two largest oceans on earth. But because of the sins of the people, God warns, I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away the hedge thereof, and it shall be eaten up. I will break down the wall thereof, and it shall be trodden down. In 1979, the Trumpet's parent magazine, The Plain Truth, identified Fidel Castro's communist revolution in Cuba as the first breach in America's protective hedge. In light of Bible prophecy and how valuable Cuba has been to America's enemies in the past, you need to watch what is happening in Cuba. Geographically, the island nation is America's weak spot.
Thank you for that. You know, it is interesting. You're talking about just the geographic advantages that America has. You know, in that prophecy, it talks about America being hedged about on all sides. And you look at just how advantaged America is geographically. This the largest ocean in the world on one side, the second largest ocean in the world on the other side. Really, Mexico is the only country that is attached that poses any kind of real threat in a sense. You've been bringing that out in what you've been talking about with respect to Mexico. But really, Cuba is you could say maybe the one point of vulnerability, if the U.S. has a point of vulnerability, and it is something that Gerald Flory's drawn attention to. This is just a really important area for us to keep our eyes on.
Yeah, that is absolutely correct. I mean, if you tried to sit down and design the perfect nation from a geographic standpoint, the United States is what you'd come up with. It's got the world's biggest continuous piece of arable land right there in the Great Plains states, all interconnected by the world's longest river system between the Mississippi and the Missouri, funneling down into the Gulf of Mexico. And then that heartland is protected, like you said, by the world's two largest oceans, the Arctic tundra to the north. And even in the case of Mexico, those deserts are hard to cross. And so it's really that Gulf of Mexico point is the America's like soft underbelly. That's where all the goods and trade from the interior of the North American continent funnel down to. And then it also is a perfect warm water port for taking those exports out and imports in, which is why 50% of America's seaborne trade comes through Gulf ports.
That's quite an extraordinary figure. With all the trade that you would be seeing off of the coasts of America, still the majority is actually coming through the Gulf.
Yeah, it's roughly 25% through Pacific ports, 25% through Atlantic ports, and then 50% through the Gulf.
Yeah.
But then you just look at the geography of the Gulf. You've got Florida jutting down, and then you've got the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico jutting up. So you've got this relatively narrow bottleneck with the island of Cuba right smack dab in the middle of it. That's what Peter Zeehan was mentioning in that point. This is, if you control Cuba and actually have the naval power to back it up,
right,
you can between the Straits of Florida on the one side and the Yucatan Channel on the other side, you can seal that off and turn the Gulf of Mexico into a lake and isolate this just huge blessing of all this agrarian land in the middle of the United States with no warm water port or no water port to get those goods available for export.
And with the United States having the most powerful navy in the world by quite a considerable margin for a long time, it makes that prophecy of a siege of the United States really something that I think a lot of people wouldn't put a lot of stock in. That you hear the way that God describes that besiegement, and you just think, well, how would that possibly happen? But there it is.
Right, there it is. I mean, black and white in your Bible, and I mean, there's obviously several perfect storm style elements that have to come together to make that that prophecy come to pass. I mean, Cuba is just geographically is just so vital to any power that would ever want to besiege the United States. But they'd also have to hit the United States at a time when there's some internal turmoil and their navies, their naval forces are weakened. And I think several organizations, Stratford and Geopolitical Futures, have pointed out that really no nation in the Western Hemisphere has a realistic chance of challenging the United States, no matter how anti-American it is, which is why the United States implemented the Monroe Doctrine of no Eastern Hemisphere interference in the Western Hemisphere. As they know, of itself, Cuba's never going to give up the power to blockade the United States. But in a case like having the Soviet Union in the last century or the European Union in this century establish a foothold on that island, now that starts getting threatening when you've got a major world power who's digging their heels in 90 miles off the coast of Florida.
Right. Yeah, which would the point that you brought out from that Gerald Fleury article about the fact that it was the Pope who opened the door for this rapprochement between the United States and Cuba under the Obama administration, it does show Europe's continued interest in securing that that land. And they've established a considerable presence in South America as well. But those efforts would continue. And then also the quote that you gave from the Cuban minister, who's basically saying that whatever business we lose from the United States, we'll just open that up to Europe all the more. So you're definitely seeing an intensification of that trend that Gerald Fleury drew attention to back when the Obama administration opened relations with Cuba.
Right. That was definitely the Pope, the past two popes, or I guess both still living, Benedict XVI and Pope Francis, had been trying to throw a lifeline to Cuba by getting America to trade with them more and getting Europe involved in there well. So they're trying to have two lifelines that would kind of keep its economy solvent and push more people into Catholicism. I mean, he'd been even Pope John Paul II had been negotiating with Fidel Castro after the island had been officially atheist for a few decades to give the Catholic Church more rights. And so the church has becoming stronger in Cuba. The popes would obviously like to continue to see the church becoming stronger in Cuba and trying to get this investment in there. But because Cuba is still supporting a dictatorial regime in Venezuela, and they've still supporting Iran, still has connections with Hezbollah. President Donald Trump had been working to reverse some of those Obama-era policies, just showing that how much of a threat it is to let Cubans come unhindered, traveling back and forth with direct flights to the United States. But as you mentioned, in a lot of ways, that that one reversing isn't going to turn the whole trend around. They're still doubling down on their outreach to Europe, because this isn't about a particular policy decision about whether there's direct flights to Cuba or not. This is getting back to that verse in Isaiah where God says, "It's because of the sins of the nation that I'm going to break the hedge of this vineyard."
Well, thanks for that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about Cuba. He wrote about this in yesterday's Trumpet Brief. This is our daily email report that you can subscribe to and receive for free if you go to thetrumpet.com. You can read his report on the website. It's called Why You Need to Watch Cuba. Thanks for your time, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
Is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
At our campus in Edmond, Oklahoma, each summer we invite teenagers from all over the world to join us for 3 weeks at Philadelphia Youth Camp. We've got 120 kids in 12 dorms, lots of activities, lots of fun, lots of instruction as well. And last week, the campers came to the KPCG studio for a tour. Our station manager asked them for their thoughts about their experiences here. He asked them about their life in the dorm and the activities that they're going through. So we're going to hear some of their responses in this montage assembled by our station manager, Dwight Falk.
Blue sky, sunshine. these royal princesses.
We are Dorm 6B, and our dorm name is Armstrong's Ambassadors for New Jerusalem.
The most memorable thing for me would be cycling.
When we were swimming yesterday, we had freestyle, and we got to jump off the diving boards.
We were playing softball, and I was at first base, and Micah Turgeon threw it at me really fast, and I missed the ball with my glove, and it bruised my forearm.
Okay, well, he didn't really move. He just, like, watched the ball just absorb into his arm the whole way. He didn't really react or anything, so I told him not to rub it, so.
Our dorm name is Asinus Sparkling Doers, and I believe we were named that because she was just a very good role model, and we said Sparkling Doers because we're supposed to be a light to the world.
That's a mouthful. Like, that's a tongue twister, that name. Say it five times fast.
Asinus.
The whole thing.
Asinus Sparkling Doers, Asinus Sparkling Doers, Asinus Sparkling Doers, Asinus Sparkling Doers, Asinus Sparkling Doers.
We're 5B, and our name is David's Inspirational Guardians.
I really liked canoeing so far, because I like canoeing, which is fine, because last year I didn't like canoeing. And volleyball is also really fun, and I'm learning how to actually go for the ball and actually hit it.
That's a big
time.
Part of the game, from what
and
I understand.
And not miss. The same thing with basketball. All the sports are just really, really fun, and I'm glad to be here.
I really enjoy dancing. I feel that it teaches us a lot about how to lead for the guys, and also you get really friendly with the girls. You just have, in a sense, of that you get to learn, you get to meet them, and you get to learn who they are. I also really enjoyed it because I actually learned how to flip a girl this year, and I didn't drop her on her head, which was amazing. So it was a personal goal of mine.
Okay, so we had a softball game today, and we've played a few now, but we've lost all of them. Well, today we tied, but I really like that sport, and I really like that we've got to play it with each other because it really enforces like a lot of teamwork, and you have to have a lot of communication with each other. Like if there's a hard hitter, you have to tell everyone to like back up, and it's a lot of skill, and it takes a lot of focus to be able to do that. And so yeah, I mean, we really enjoyed it, and we played well together. We had good attitudes, even though we're not very good at it. You might be good at soccer, you might be good at track, but when it comes to softball, that's our sport. You should sit back with someone at the home plate. We're going to hit it high. And even though we love your dorm, we'll still make that ball fly. Go someone.
Okay, I'd just like to start off. I'm not on the A team, but the B team is doing really well. Let's see. The A team, I've watched them a lot, and they have great teamwork, great communication, and that's a lot of the key to the sport is communication and passing the ball. So I think with the A team, they're doing really well on that. Their inspiration and communication is key.
Well, we are Dorm 4B, and our dorm name is Hezekiah's Heroic Historians, and obviously that ties into the recent finds with the Bulle and, you know, all the history that's involved with it, and we just found it to be, you know, a great tie-in and very inspiring name.
We are Dorm 4G, and our name is Sarah's Serving Stones. When we got back to the dorm after orientation night, our counselor, Miss Weeks, kind of just really told us all to make it our dorm motto that we serve, and just really, she really kind of pounded that into us, just saying, you know, serve more and do everything you can to serve. It's better to serve than to get. And of course, it's like all over our walls in the dorm. There's posters saying serving, serve, I serve, serve this mm-hmm. kind of thing. And so that's really our dorm motto.
That's great. She, of course, was over there on one of the digs. So has she been able to bring some of that, like her experience into, you know, some of the things you guys are doing?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. On our dorm walls, actually, she put up pictures that she took at the dig, and so one night she did tell us a little bit about it, and of course there's this huge poster of just Jerusalem itself in there, and it's just gorgeous to look at. And of course she's just really an amazing counselor. She's always really inspiring and just telling us her stories and everything, and so we really do love her.
Just to be on the dig, that'd be just awesome. Go to Jerusalem and dig for God's college, that'd just be great.
What would you hope to find?
Ark of the Covenant.
That's what everybody wants to find. Here's the question, though. Do you touch it if you find it?
No, sir.
So in Mr. Turgeon's orientation, he told us to strive to make it our goal to go to Jerusalem and to go on the dig and to experience that for ourselves. And so I made that one of my goals, life goals, is to go to the dig in Jerusalem and just to like experience the Bible coming to life. Because like I guess when you dig up the artifacts, like you can see like firsthand, like this is wow.
Yeah, they're real, sort of real thing. People yeah. having real experiences, doing real things, just like us. Yes, yeah. Sir.
Well, so far, my favorite part has been the trip we took yesterday. We went to Arcadia Bay, I believe, and there for roughly 3 or 4 hours, we spent time on a speedboat, skiing, tubing, kneeboarding, which is all really fun. And we were all separated. One half stayed behind, and the half that got to stay behind, you know, we switched off. We got to relax at the beach, and it was so like relaxing and invigorating, and just it was a really nice time and a lot of fun.
Yeah,
a lot of sunburn too.
I got the skis on, and then I grabbed the rope, and I was, because you say hit it when you want to take off, so I was like hit it, and then he hits it, and he takes off, and then I was like, my face was under the water, and he was going pretty fast, and I was just getting like waterboarded for like a good like 5 seconds, and it was pretty yummy.
Well, when our half of the dorm was, when we weren't going on the boat, we went to the beach and just went swimming around. And so there's some buoys to block off how far you can go. And we swam out to the buoys, and we were kind of joking with each other with what was in the water, because it was really murky and you couldn't see anything. But then all of a sudden, I don't know exactly what it was, but I'm pretty sure it was a fish. It jumped out of the water and it hit me in the head and then jumped back in. And some of the other girls also felt something like swim by them. And so I kind of got really scared and I screamed, of course. But then I was like, what was that? And then another one of my dorm mates was like, I saw some sort of wormy thing. So we all started screaming, and then we just bolted back to the shore.
The mystery of the wormy thing.
So I was on the getting ready on the wakeboard, the kneeboarding, and then it was my first time, so I was kind of excited, kind of nervous, mix of both. And then I shouted, hit it. He goes, and nothing happens, and like the thing just gets stuck and tangled.
Yeah.
So he jumps in. So now I'm nervous because I'm like, oh, what's gonna happen? What happened? Is the boat? Did something happen to the boat? So then he just untangles it and then fixes the knot because it broke. So it was take two now. I said hit it, and then the rope broke again, like just a separate time. So now I'm really like, okay, what's going on? Of course, it's me that's happening to. But third time's the charm. Got on.
What I learned was how to actually waltz. There was the mambo. Bumbo, jumbo, whatever, whatever that's called. I can't remember how to do it. I learned how to twirl a girl, which was pretty sweet.
I was nervous about it, and my goal for Stig Night was to not be that guy who drops the girl in the middle of the dance floor.
Did you succeed so far?
Yes, I have. No, excellent. I'm pretty proud of it.
Okay, hello, I'm Scott Hirma. Our dorm is 3B, and our name is Hezekiah's United Legion of Kings. And we just wanted to like tie it in with like the exhibit and new throne, new stone, and the acronym is Hulk. So
that's cool. And you have green shirts, which is perfect. Yeah. Excellent. That's way to think that through.
Dorm 3G, and our name is the Faithful Daughters of Hephzibah. One, it sounded cool, and two, is because Hephzibah is Isaiah's daughter.
I started off with a nice run, but I tried to get it going, like throwing the ball, but. It didn't work. I guess either it's my throwing or they're catching, but I'm not sure which one it is. It could be both, you know. But I almost threw an interception, so I just started running it a lot instead of not giving the ball over to other team. Well, while I'm on the radio station, I can say I could do a little better with my passing, but I guess we all can improve as a dorm. Well, I got two big guys.
Okay.
My first big guy, I call him DD, but it's Dylan Davis. My second man, my strong man is Mr. Scott Hirma, Mr. Strong Legs.
I like volleyball.
The only thing we're good at right now is cheering. I just like wooing. Woo! Thank you.
Yeah, then I guess your brother Dorm could say that they were wooed by you. So that would be
yes,
something
I
that
always
could be,
woo for them.
That could be said. Excellent.
You guys better run your routes, though.
Run your routes. If you want to be wooed, you better run your routes.
Hello. We are 2B, and our dorm name is Samuel Steadfast Soldiers.
We are 2G, and our dorm name is Mazar's Magnificent Maidens. And I think it ties in really directly with our camp theme, Let the Stone Speak, because Mazar is the archaeological person.
The archaeologist.
The archaeologist. And we think that that's really important to let the stone speak with tying her right in. What really inspired me the most is the new stone, Mr. Armstrong's prayer rock. It's just so inspiring to see that in person and like how this ties directly in with the new throne that Jesus Christ himself is going to reign on. And it's just so inspiring to be that close and to see it with your own eyes. It makes the whole vision more real and everything about it, and just encourages you to keep fighting, because that's what we're fighting for, the new throne, and how we'll all be able to rule it, Jesus Christ's right hand one day.
I really liked the model of the Ezekiel temple on the bottom floor of the Hall of Administration, because just like seeing this model and seeing just the grand scale of it, how like inside the little like figurines of human figurines are like ants, they're so small, because it just like shows how big this temple is going to be. And it really paints a picture of what our part in that time is going to be, and that's really inspiring.
My favorite part of the activities from the camp was flag football, and it just shows that if you have a good connection with your dorm, then you can make a lot of excellent plays, and that you know that you're very close with everybody in your dorm.
Softball is my favorite activity, because it really helps your dorm with teamwork, and especially some of the quieter girls, you really have to like call out the girl's name that you're throwing the ball to, and it just helps with teamwork. GOODEYE, good eye, good eye, good eye.
I like volleyball because it helps everyone work as a team, and like you have to, like even if you don't like hit, there's always someone like back there who can help you with it.
I think I was a little intimidated at first, but now that I'm here, I'm like, this is the best thing I've ever done, and I'm so glad I applied for camp.
Like, at first, when we all, first day, everybody was quiet, and we didn't talk at all, but now we just all laugh all the time.
So the first day, it was complete silence?
Yes, sir.
No one said a word. Well, that's what happens, and then they can't get you to stop talking, usually. Is anybody talking their sleep, by the way? Have you guys experienced that? You wake up and this guy's saying something?
Yes, sir.
What do you say? Do you know? Do they tell you what you say?
I mainly grunt or yell. And Mr. Hirma said one time I yelled, "You're not a girl."
Last year, we were sleeping, and it was kind of in the middle of the night, and I woke up screaming eggs.
Eggs.
Yes, eggs.
You were ready for breakfast. You were.
Yes.
Were you terrified or were you like excited?
I don't know. I just yelled it out. My favorite dance is the swing, because I'm more of a upbeat person, and when it comes to slow dances, I just get really confused and I don't know why.
Well, I like the line dance, the one where we dance to Happy.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, it's hard to get at first, but then once you get it, you start feeling and stuff, and you don't care. You don't care what anybody's, like, how you look or whatever. You just feel the beat, and you start dancing.
Yeah. For the radio audience that couldn't see that, he actually did a little move for us.
I just talking it?
Yep.
Okay.
You can sing or yodel, but... Yeah.
So we're 1G, and... hopefully I'm saying it right, Abijah's Fiery Stones. And we chose Abijah because she is Hezekiah's mother. And Mr. Turgeon mentioned her in his orientation message the first day of camp. And he had something to say about how Hezekiah turned out to be a great king of Judah. And how basically he couldn't have gotten where he was today without his mother, because his father, Ahaz, was such a terrible guy. and so his mom must have had something to do with it.
We are 1B, and our name is Isaiah's Honorable Ophel Brotherhood. There's lots of reasons for each individual part of that, but the main point that we wanted to force the acronym IHOB, so we thought that would be pretty funny. But obviously with what the PCG is doing and the Ophel area with the dig site, what Isaiah was able to do with Hezekiah, and because we're guys, so brotherhood, and hopefully honorable. We'll see how that goes.
My favorite activity so far has been flag football. We've had 2 games so far. I didn't think we were going to do amazing in football, but it just so turns out that our chemistry is really working for us. We've won both of the games we've played and had a lot of fun doing so, spread the ball around, and I think we all enjoyed it.
Favorite activity, soccer.
I'm a worker now. I was a camper 4 times. I dealt with some pretty unpleasant heat, so I'm very excited that my boys are going to have to deal with the warm weather. It's character building.
In the words of Mr. Burns, hydrate.
I call it Vitalite, personally, but it's the nectar of the gods, and it's really good. I was in sick bay for a couple days, and that's the only reason why I really did want to get better, because I knew that when I got out, I could have extra Vitalite.
So it's like a treat to you.
Yeah, it's the best.
You're addicted to it. Wow.
Yeah, like when I see them pour the packet in, I just want to walk over and like slap the packet so it all goes in.
Yeah, in the words of Mr. Eric Burns, that will be fine.
It's time for today's last word.
What's the hardest thing for a human being to do? Thanks to pernicious human nature, of all the strenuous, formidable, even heartbreaking things you can face, perhaps the most difficult is this: when you're wrong, to truly admit it so you can change it. This truth came to mind watching congressional testimony from a top FBI agent. This man was involved in investigating Hillary Clinton's email scandal, Russia's involvement in the 2016 U.S. presidential elections, the Trump-Russia dossier, the leak of the Democratic National Committee emails, and on and on and on. This man was also committing adultery with an FBI colleague. The thousands of text messages he exchanged with her communicated his bias against Trump and his supporters. But when this man's actions were exposed, the world found out about his adultery, his political prejudice, and his obvious motivation to use his power to damage a presidential candidate, he was called before members of Congress to give nationally televised testimony accounting for his actions. And there, this guilty man boldly, consistently, and defiantly insisted he was perfectly innocent. The more evidence of his wrongdoing that was laid before him, the more combative and condescending he became. When one congressman questioned his integrity, he called that insulting. He said, "I take offense." His defiance included a smirk so noticeable that a congressman called him out on it, saying he wondered how often the man had looked into his wife's eyes and lied about his adultery. Somehow, this individual had managed to rise to a very high position, paid with American tax dollars, within a high-level law enforcement agency. To me, that speaks volumes about the current state of America's government. But as unique and egregious as this man's situation is, his spirit of the self being right, even when shown to be wrong, has become common in America. In fact, it's prevailed throughout human history, and it can easily plague your own life. The question is, what happens to those who never admit fault, who never accept correction? Proverbs 29 verse 1 says, "He that being often reproved hardens his neck shall suddenly be destroyed, and that without remedy." like a plane whose yoke is never turned or pulled. They fly off course and crash. The truth is, we are pitiful blind creatures without God. Yet naturally, we take on the mindset of the devil, who won't admit his failures and will still be insisting on his innocence and righteousness when he's finally cast into outer darkness. This is the fundamental reason why human civilization has a history and an immediate future dominated by misery, injustice, strife, and failure, because man naturally rejects correction. America is a colossal example. This nation is being chastened, corrected, and humbled in countless ways, yet this isn't arousing in people any spirit of contrition or sense of repentance. People on every side of every issue are just digging in deeper, doubling down on the supposed correctness of their own position. With engines on full throttle and the mountainside coming into view, we still insist self is right. But we all need correction. You know, there's nothing sweeter than a child who's done something wrong and who responds to his parents' correction and turns away from a wrong attitude and toward a humble repentance. Well, God is a loving Father, and He'll give us loving correction, not just through troubles and curses, but through the pages of His Word and through His servants, if only we will accept it. Here are four quick points to taking advantage of God's precious correction. One, stop fighting it. Acknowledge that you have a deep-seated carnal resistance to being corrected. You've got to get rid of that resentment. Two, pray for it. Regularly pray that God will correct you in His mercy. You need that persistent contact with God in order to live the way of God is right, not self is right. Three, accept it. Correction will come in different forms. Don't focus on the means by which it comes. Focus on whether it is true. And four, apply it. If you humble yourself enough to do the first three points, it doesn't get you anywhere if you don't follow through and put the correction into action. Hebrews 12 and verse 5 says, "My son, despise you not the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when you are rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives." Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has talked about just how important it is to embrace correction and to thank God for it. When you apply correction and you accept it and embrace it, it always brings growth and blessings. Like flying a plane, living a good human life requires constant correction, adjustment, and improvement. And what happens to those who are correctable before God is not just a good life, but achieving their incredible human potential. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Jeremiah Jacques and Andrew Miller. Thanks to Dwight Falk for his PYC montage and for his technical assistance on the rest of the program. And thanks to Josh Sloan, our recording engineer. I'll leave you with this thought from Henry David Thoreau. It is not enough to be industrious, so are the ants. What are you industrious about? Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.